hate trending today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Hate crimes in the U.S. have spiked since the election. What if they continue?
If this trend doesn't stop, we are really in deep trouble because interracial, interethnic attacks, interreligious attacks are attacks that tend to split society along pre-existing fault lines.
Plus, The Daily Show's Trevor Noah talks about growing up biracial in South Africa.
According to the law, I was a person who was superior to half of my family because they were black and I was half white.
And the people of Finland want their own emojis, including one for a popular curse word.
Perkele, for example, smash your finger with a hammer or something is very useful.
Go get a hammer, that and more today here on The World. Thanks for being with us today. I don't know about you, but I'm getting ready to seriously limit my Facebook diet. The campaign seemed to ratchet up everyone's sharing of memes and news and fake news. No one seemed immune from it. And quite often the posts were from the choir for the choir. If you are still using social media, though, you've probably seen some items in your feed, real news stories, it seems, about acts of hate and harassment or ethnic intimidation, as the Ann Arbor police referred to the harassment of a Muslim student at the University of Michigan last week. But are all the reports true, and how much of this trend is new? The civil rights group, the Southern Poverty Law Center, is collecting some hard data, and Mark Potok is one of their senior fellows. So, Mark, how bad is it? What kind of change have we seen?
Well, anecdotally, it's been kind of incredible. We put up a forum on our website asking people to report these kinds of incidents to us, and we also began collecting simply reports that were appearing in local media around the country, and we are already at 400 incidents. I have to say, you know, we have not verified all of these independently at all. And it's true that there are apparently some fake stories out there. There's apparently one of the women who said she had her hijab ripped off, was not telling the truth. But still, I think it's indisputable that we're seeing a big rash of hate crimes and hate incidents, kind of lesser crimes that are directly related to the election of Donald Trump.
So I mentioned Sadiq Muhammad, the student at the University of Michigan. That story was real. I got several sources on it. But what other examples are there since last Tuesday that you have validated?
Oh, I mean, there are so many, it's hard to say other than to characterize them. We've heard lots and lots of reports of Muslim kids being bullied. We have heard reports of black people being attacked, of being screamed at, told to quote-unquote, go back to Africa, that kind of thing, similar things said to other foreigners. You know, we don't know exactly how this compares to prior periods, but I can say that on an anecdotal level, we haven't seen anything like this since the morning after Barack Obama was first elected as our first black president. Back then, we saw a similar rash of angry incidents and hate crimes across the country.
President-elect Donald Trump has kind of expressed shock by these incidents. He's called on people to knock it off, that he wants to bind the wounds of division. What do you make of that?
A day late and a dollar short. The man has spent the better part of a year and a half doing precisely the opposite. You know, it's all very nice that Donald Trump has become a no-hate guy opposed to violence, but it seems awfully late in the game.
Women have also been targeted, if one is to believe even a fraction of some of the reports. Are women a new demographic for the Southern Poverty Law Center?
Not that new. We began about 4 years ago to really write about organized misogyny. That's when we ran across a kind of underworld on the internet, which is known as the manosphere. These are actually organized groups that do things like recommend the quote-unquote corrective rape of women for being sort of uppity. I mean, they're really, it's an incredible world. So it is true, I think, that misogyny is very much growing. It's very rife in the white supremacist movement. And of course, Donald Trump, personally, as a candidate, has been accused of pretty loathsome misogyny on his own part.
So it's hard to say how this trend will continue in the first months of a Trump presidency. But, I mean, how are you at the Southern Poverty Law Center preparing for the new administration?
It's kind of all hands on deck here. We're getting an enormous number of phone calls and other contacts. There are really huge numbers of people who want to do something. So, you know, we're just dealing with all of that. We're trying to keep track of the large number of hate crimes that have occurred in the last few days. You know, I would say, though, overall, I would expect this rash of hate crimes to diminish in the next couple of weeks. We certainly don't know that for sure. But a comparison, it seems to me, is with what happened in the United Kingdom immediately after the Brexit vote to leave the European Union.
But what if that trend doesn't cease here in the United States? You at the Southern Poverty Law Center will have a lot of work on your hands.
That's right. I mean, if this trend doesn't stop, we are really in deep trouble.
That was Mark Potok, senior fellow with the Southern Poverty Law Center. Here's something else that's become part of Trump talk, the alt-right. Now, when I first came across the word alt a few years ago, I thought it was a weird key on my computer keyboard or a fringe music designation like alt-country or alt-folk. But alt-right? That's a whole new level of alt. Andrew Morantz of The New Yorker is here to help us understand the alt-right. So let's start with a description of what we call the alt-right today, Andrew, here in the U.S. How would you characterize it? Is it a movement?
I think it's less an ideology than a sensibility. And it's actually, you know, it might not be as unlike alt-folk and alt-country as you might think, actually, because it's not just more right than the right. It's not just more extreme. It's different in the same way that, you know, alt-country is not just really country music, it's a different kind of country music. So this is a kind of right-wing thinking that does not really want to compromise on certain things, does not want to compromise on immigration or white nationalism or, you know, any number of intellectual positions that used to be up for political grabs and used to require lots of sort of intricate compromises. And now the thinking is, let's just rewrite the rules.
So as far as being kind of uber-conservatism, the Anti-Defamation League defines the alt-right as people, quote, who reject mainstream conservatism in favor of forms of conservatism that embrace implicit or explicit racism or white supremacy. Would you agree with that definition?
Yeah, it depends on who we're talking about. There are lots of members of the alt-right who do not consider themselves members of the alt-right, you know, and who would reject the terminology. There are some who are openly white nationalist, others who claim not to be. So it's a broad coalition. I think there are certainly some people who are members of the alt-right, who are in some sense the founding members of the alt-right, who are openly white nationalist, they call it, you know, or identitarian, they sometimes call themselves, who are interested in, you know, preserving European power and European-American power. There are other people who are just sort of chaos agents who, you know, could take that or leave it, but are sort of on board for other reasons.
Now we've got Steve Bannon, the head of the alt-right Breitbart media organization, as Trump's chief strategist. How will that change the place the alt-right has had in the U.S., do you think?
It will go from a completely ignorable fringe group to the absolute center of the American media narrative. It's a complete overnight shift. You know, Andrew Breitbart started this thing that was kind of, you know, a mini Drudge Report. It was back in the days of media when social media had not yet fully taken over. And so there was still a kind of media monoculture where you could subscribe to the newspapers you subscribe to and watch the TV channels you watched and you know, not worry about something like the Drudge Report or like Breitbart.com. Now everything spreads so easily through social networks and other things that everyone's part of totally fractured and ever-changing media landscape. And in that landscape, Breitbart has gone from the fringe to the center extremely quickly.
Is the alt-right here in the U.S. networked with similar groups in Europe?
Oh, yeah, very openly. I mean, Breitbart has an office in London. They're looking to open offices in Germany and France. Their front page, I think, like right after Trump got elected, their front page, at least when I went to the site, was a piece by Geert Wilders, the Netherlands nationalist, saying, you know, this is a worldwide movement. So, yeah, it's definitely networked, at least in Europe.
Are they helping conservative groups here talk to groups in Norway, for example?
Well, you know, Donald Trump has said many times that he doesn't like to divulge too much of his strategy. So there are certain parts of the strategy that, you know, we don't know unless we're in the war room. But yeah, there are definitely conversations happening across country lines. You know, Nigel Farage was on the stump campaigning for Trump in Mississippi. Geert Wilders, as I said, has, you know, openly voiced his support for Trump. Marine Le Pen's people have said that they have been talking to Trump. Trump, for that matter, has said he's talked to Putin. So there's certainly communication going on both at the level of, you know, media strategy and at the level of just political strategy.
So if you had to kind of describe the differences between the far right in Europe and the alt-right here, what would you say they are?
Every country is different. I think a common thread is what they would call secure borders and what a lot of people would call extreme nationalism, shutting down immigration, deporting people who are already in your country, painting immigrants as violent threat. You know, that's the kind of thing that is common to right-wing neo-fascist movements throughout the world, and that's something we've seen even before Trump, you know, with Golden Dawn and Hungary. It's been happening in many places for a long time. It's hard to say to what extent that is alt-right, because the alt-right is really an American creation. Mm. But, you know, I think a lot of these groups will use whatever memes happen to be convenient to their advantage.
Andrew Marantz has been writing about the alt-right for The New Yorker. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Emojis, those little hieroglyphics you can add to texts and messages. Let's just say people want retail democracy with emojis. Everyone wants to see themselves represented. That's why the Unicode Consortium, yes, there is a group that approves new emoticons for use worldwide. They've been super busy lately, adding new emojis that reflect the different skin tones, gender roles, and cultural characteristics of the people who use them. The process of adding emojis doesn't usually involve national governments, except in Finland. Earlier this year, the government in Helsinki published its own set of 49 Finland-themed emojis, like a sauna. Yep, the Finns have an emoji for that.
Finland is the first country to even to suggest emojis that have some sort of a cultural connection.
That's Petra Thiemann with Finland's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. She's trying to get her country's emojis onto smartphones everywhere. One emoji that's close to her heart is called woolly socks.
For Finns, the woolly socks is kind of a symbol of like something that really warms you up from the inside. And usually, you know, they're made by your grandmother. So I think I personally have something like 30, 40 pairs of different woolly socks. And they're all done by elderly ladies that I love. So they have that sort of a very warm feeling to the Finns.
I hear some Finns even wear woolly socks with sandals. Yeah, it's a look. And there's an emoji for that, too. There's also one featuring the thing modern Finland is best known for, a Nokia cell phone. That one is called Unbreakable. If you've ever had a Nokia, you know. And then there's one you probably wouldn't learn in a classroom.
Oh, this is such a good curse word. I suggest everybody start using Finnish curse words because we have a lot of consonants. So the curse word is perkele. And it's very useful. I mean, in case you, for example, smash your finger with a hammer or something, it's very useful. P-R-K-L. Perkele.
Yeah, try it. Perkele. Rolls right off the tongue, and you don't even need a hammer. The Finnish government has asked Unicode to approve some of its emojis, and so far two have been actively considered. The woolly socks got a quick green light, but Thiemann says there was an issue with the sauna emoji. It shows a naked cartoon couple in the sauna, pretty innocent, and there's no way to determine the gender, if you know what I mean. But Thiemann says Unicode wants a few more clothes on them.
I mean, we've had discussions with Unicode about modifying them. Obviously, for a Finn, it's really not a sauna if you're there with a bikini on or a swimsuit on. And I mean, anyways, in the Finland emojis, the naked people, you can't really see anything. They're done in a very prude way. I mean, you notice they're naked, but you cannot see anything.
Still, look for that sauna emoji and the woolly socks one on your smartphone soon. The first Unicode-approved Finnish emojis should be included in software updates in the coming months, just in time for a nice winter sauna with more emojis coming next year. You can see a few of Finland's emoji collection at PRI.org. You're with The World. All this week, we're featuring stories from our language podcast, The World in Words. Today, my colleague Jeb Sharp joins me. Hey, Jeb.
Hi, Marco.
So your story is about a young Afghan refugee you met in Brussels, right?
Yes. Maysem Hosseini was 13 when I met him last winter. His first language is Dari. And my story for The World in Words is about him learning Dutch, which is one of Belgium's main languages. Mm. But it's also the story of a couple I met in Brussels, Catherine McSweeney and Thomas Van Houten, who took Maysem and his parents in off the streets when they first arrived. They'd been on the road for months. And I'm going to play you a few excerpts from the podcast episode. Here's Catherine describing their first moments with the Afghan family.
They actually slept for 5 days. I mean, for almost 5 days, every time I would come downstairs, they were fast asleep. I think they were so exhausted, and any time they woke up, it was just to eat and to to be cared for medically because they were also very sick. They each had lung infections.
When they did emerge from their slumber, this is a family of three, 13-year-old Maysam, his mother Aziza, and father Noraga. Catherine and Thomas learned something about them they hadn't understood before.
Whenever I tried to talk to them, the father would say, "Maysam speaks English, Maysam speaks English." And we quickly realized Maysam doesn't really speak English. He picked up some words along the way, apparently in Iran, I think. I also remember trying to show Noraga my phone number and him not being able to read the numbers. But then I tried to show him on his phone and I wrote down the numbers as they were on his phone and I realized he couldn't read that either. So then I realized that he was probably illiterate and I saw their documents and the signature wasn't really a signature. And then I think it's when Thomas started to try to teach English to Maysam that we realized he hadn't held a pen before or, you know, sat with paper and tried to learn before. So I think we realized that they were from a very rural background. Yeah, that's the family that we had.
So Jeb, what brought Maysam Hosseini and his family from Afghanistan to Belgium?
The simple answer is the Taliban. Mm-hmm. They are refugees and they made one of those epic journeys last year that we've heard so much about. They're from Wardak province, not far from Kabul. They set out for Kandahar and then the border with Pakistan and then on through Iran to Turkey by boat to Greece.
Wow.
And then up the Balkan route all the way to Western Europe. And back home, they were small farmers, shepherds, basically. So this is the boy, Maysam, describing an encounter with two Taliban fighters while he was out grazing the sheep. And they started badgering him and asking him what he was doing and where he lived. They threatened him. They said they wanted him to place something in a police car for them, presumably a bomb. He said he would talk to his parents, and they said, "Okay, we'll see you back here in the morning." But when he went home and told his parents, they told him not to go back. And that incident turned out to be the last straw for the family. The boy's father had been attacked a few years before. A cousin had been killed by the Taliban. And they tried to find another safe place to graze the sheep. But after 10 days, they decided to sell up and flee like so many others before them.
Wow. So now they're in Belgium. But what happens next for Maysam? Because, I mean, if, as Catherine discovered, he's illiterate in his own language, can he learn to read in a second language before he even masters the first one?
This is the question that fascinated me. I mean, there are many questions, obviously, about a journey and a life like this. But for The World in Words, I wanted to know what it was like to learn a second language when you're non-literate in your first one. What I learned is that it usually takes kids like Maysam longer to learn that second language. Or to put it another way, it's easier to learn to read and write a second language if you read and write in your own, partly because there are all kinds of things the brain does automatically in learning a second language if it's already had the practice in learning
right.
The first one. And as with literate kids, dual language programs where you keep learning in your first language as you learn the second can really help that learning. But in many situations today, think about all the migrations we're seeing, this 65 million people on the move around the world. It's just not possible to cater to every kid in that way. The good news with Maysam is that Catherine and Thomas, the host family, advocated to have him move to a school with a special language program. I got to visit him there last February and meet the director, Christoph van Henechten, and also see him in the classroom with one of his teachers.
Ik ben 16 jaar.
Hoe oud ben jij?
30.
Maysam's new teacher is engaging and dynamic, full of encouraging smiles as she cajoles the kids through a series of exercises, pointing to diagrams on a set of oversized cards. It all looks very promising, seeing these kids who've come from war zones leaning in, answering, valiantly wrapping their tongues around unfamiliar words. When I ask Christoph van Henechten about Maysam's prospects, though, he's sober.
What's the potential for someone starting at 13?
Well, to be honest, it's very difficult to learn a language, and 13 is already quite old. You need at least 7 years to learn a language quite well. Here in Belgium, They can go to a special school like ours for 1.5, maximum 2 years. And then they need to be ready to go to a regular school. But then you don't go to the high level. So it's going to be hard. Everybody comes here and wants to be a lawyer or a doctor. But I never met one.
He gets pretty emotional telling me about working in the school, how the teachers become mother and father figures to the kids, how strong the bonds are, how close-knit the team.
Yes, it's very intense. And, oh. Right, eh? Ah, that comes home.
Break for you.
Yeah.
Dus Len had in campus staff with Christophe, goedemorgen.
Jeb, that's not very encouraging, but I don't know. How's Meisem doing?
I know, it does sound a little bleak, doesn't it? But it's actually an amazing school, and I came away feeling quite inspired. That was one moment in a longer interview. And I have been checking in with Catherine since, and Meisem is actually thriving.
He's, oh, fantastic.
His oral Dutch skills are absolutely soaring, and he can now call Catherine and Thomas and their kids on the phone and talk about his day in Dutch. When I was there doing all these interviews, which was last February, he told me at one point that he wants to be a doctor or an engineer. Now he's in this new place, in this new life. And his teachers say whether or not that's possible or whether or not that dream comes true, the very fact that he has that dream is incredibly good for him, good for his brain, good for his motivation. It will help him go as far as he can possibly go.
You met my son when he was 13. He's now 14. How does this story end?
You'll have to listen to the podcast.
Of course it will.
But the story does not really have an ending. Obviously, he's a teenager. Mm. But also, Meisem and his family have a crucial asylum interview coming up. And they will have to make the case for being allowed to stay in Belgium. And there are no guarantees there. But I will keep you posted.
Thanks very much for telling us the story up to this point anyway, Jeb. The world's Jeb Sharp. And you can listen to all of Meisem's story on the World in Words podcast. Subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. You're with The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. Comedian Trevor Noah grew up in South Africa. Now he's hosting The Daily Show here in the U.S., and he thinks about his identity a lot.
I have to remind myself that I'm half black, half white. One thing you learn very quickly as a biracial person is that one half is just completely ignored.
Trevor Noah, coming up right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Here's one word from the presidential campaign we won't soon forget. Rigged. As in, the process was rigged. Bernie Sanders supporters said it during the primaries. Donald Trump said it often after he was nominated. But really, where does the U.S. stand when it comes to corruption? We turn to Sarah Chase to talk about that. She studies corruption, democracies, and the rule of law at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Chase spent time in Afghanistan, where she saw corruption up close. Real street-level stuff, like bribing the police or a local official. Chase says it's different here.
The way we experience corruption in the United States isn't the in-your-face variety at street level. But what we are experiencing is the undue influence of a network, if you will, that weaves together political and business leaders that have rewritten much of our legislation to serve their purposes. They have taken control of now a really significant number of the instruments of government. And those institutions that may retain some independence have been systematically hollowed out. I mean, look at the vacancies in judicial positions. Look at the under-resourcing of many of those institutions, regulatory bodies, and so on. And this is precisely the type of structured corruption that I've been looking at in places like Azerbaijan, in places like, you know, Honduras. So I think it really behooves us as Americans to think through what is the meaning of corruption in America. I mean, one of the things that makes it difficult for us is that our foundation, one of the bulwarks of what we consider our system of democracy and rule of law, is precisely that. It's respect for the laws. The problem is when the kleptocracy gets a hold of legislation, saying that corruption is what's forbidden by law becomes a tautology. You can just write the laws so that it renders that practice legal.
So
that's not a good definition of corruption.
When we read reports from Transparency International, it's always Nigeria or Venezuela in deep, dark red corruption on the map. But the U.S. comes out pretty clean. Should we be using a new gauge for corruption?
Yes, we should. That index is a very useful tool, but the methodology is extremely problematic. It's basically asking essentially business leaders about their perceptions of corruption. Well, business leaders have been the ones who have helped rig the system that we're living under in the United States.
Right. So the role of corruption in Donald Trump's election last Tuesday, I mean, do you think most Americans see what's happening in Washington and think, yeah, it's the same everywhere, it's all corruption? Or is there kind of a double standard here in the U.S. that allows people, you know, to think that money and democracy, it's bound to get complicated, but it's not corruption the way we see, you know, the kleptocracies in other parts of the world?
So your question raises two really interesting issues. One is, it is almost taboo to talk about the C word in the kind of, I hate to use this expression, but among the elites, among the sort of political and intellectual elites in America when referring to the United States. So you just mentioned Transparency International. It has a chapter in the United States. The Transparency International chapters in various countries, their role is to identify, decry, and work against corruption in their countries. Have you ever heard Transparency International US talking about corruption in America? I mean, it's as though there's this taboo to think about our country this way, and yet 70% of the electorate was galvanized. If you take Trump and Sanders voters together, something like 70% of the U.S. electorate was galvanized by the explicit description of the United States as a country that's corrupt. And yet still, the political and intellectual elites can't even talk in those terms. The second really interesting point that your question raises is the irony, you know, of a guy who's in bed with Yanukovych and in bed with, you know, Aliyev in Azerbaijan running on an anti-corruption campaign. And this is the second parallel with a lot of the countries where I've studied extreme reactions to corruption, like Afghanistan, like Iraq, like, you know, Nigeria, is that people are so indignant and desperate at the corruption of their system that they are often vulnerable to the kind of siren songs of organizations that are even more corrupt. Ironically, we're going to wake up with a far more corrupt system with Trump in power than we had before.
Sarah Chase with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thanks very much for your thoughts.
Thank you, Marco.
If you're an American and you adopt a child now from overseas, your kid automatically becomes a U.S. citizen. That's been the law since 2001. Before that, though, adoptive parents had to file paperwork for citizenship, and thousands of them did not follow through on this. As a result, some older adoptees are left in limbo, American but not officially American. That's a case for a woman now living in South Korea who's desperate to come home to the U.S. Here's reporter Kaomi Goetz with her story from Seoul.
When Kim Craig was 5 years old, she was adopted from South Korea by a Minnesota family. She's 49 now, and when I meet her at a coffee shop in Seoul, she looks like a typical American tourist. No makeup, casual clothes. And she orders her coffee in English. But technically, Craig is not an American, and she's someone who's had to adjust constantly to change.
When I did live here, I was shuffled from family member to family member, so I think I probably learned very early how to adjust and accept my circumstances.
That shuffling continued in the U.S. Her adoptive mother was abusive and gave her up after a year. Craig was sent to live with another family in Minnesota. That didn't work out either. She remembers having to project a certain family image, but it was a lie.
I don't have a lot of memories there other than maybe outside the home. But inside the home, very few other than getting beatings.
At 13, she tried to kill herself. She ran away and started drinking. When authorities tried to send her back, Craig refused to go. Her adoptive mother's response was, fine.
She said, well, you're going to get what you want. We're going to give up our rights. And as she was leaving out the door, she said, and oh, by the way, you're not a citizen. And at the time, I didn't know what that meant.
What it meant was her adoptive parents never filed the paperwork for her citizenship. So even though she was raised as an American, she even joined the military, she wasn't a U.S. citizen. She got close once to getting her papers, but she missed the swearing-in ceremony.
As most things, I have a tendency to screw things up.
Craig got married, had five kids, got divorced. As a single mother, she never thought of making a trip to Korea. But one of her teenage daughters was a fan of K-pop, specifically the band SHINee.
She kept playing the music and it was driving me nuts. I mean, literally, I'm like, what are you listening to? Stop. Actually, I love them now. They are my favorite.
Her daughters wanted to learn more about their Korean background. They persuaded Craig to take them to Korea. She couldn't get a U.S. passport, but she could get a Korean one. So they came for a three-month visit. Craig says from the start, she felt a jolt of recognition. Familiar smells, familiar images. And there was this.
First time in my life that I can remember walking and I looked like everyone else.
Just as they were getting ready to go home, though, Craig lost her wallet. It had her U.S. permanent residence card, which she needed to return. She says she went to the U.S. Embassy in Seoul for help, but they turned her away because she wasn't a citizen.
And I said, no, excuse me, it's not my fault. I said, I didn't ask for this. I said, I'm a permanent resident. You guys took me out of this country, put me in this country. I only speak English. I can't speak Korean. You guys have to help me.
Eventually, someone listened and agreed to help. That's when she learned how complicated her situation was. She couldn't get her residence card replaced while outside the U.S. And without the card, there was no guarantee she'd be let in.
I don't know how often that happens. That is something that is actually technically correct.
Karen Christensen oversees citizen services for the State Department at consulates all over the world. She couldn't speak about Craig's case, but she says immigration officials do have that final say over border entries. And even if Kim entered as a visitor, she might jeopardize her status. Christensen sees how hard this is for adoptees like Craig.
It's a very difficult situation for the children, and these individuals aren't the ones who were, it wasn't a failure on their part to take an action. I would suggest that if they are now adults, that they approach Department of Homeland Security, USCIS, and see about naturalizing in their own right, that they take the step themselves.
Yet it's not so simple. Advocates say adult adoptees must apply like any other immigrant. It can cost thousands of dollars in attorney's fees and paperwork, not to mention a psychological toll. In 2001, the law changed so that foreign adoptees could automatically become citizens. But that didn't cover those over 18, like Kim Craig. There is a proposal to fix that loophole. But for now, Craig's three-month trip to Korea has stretched into 3 years, and it's hard for her to find work. She has a part-time job teaching English. Two of her kids are still here, and they pitch in. But she's in debt.
And I try not to think about it on a daily basis that I just want to go home. But I can't. So I don't think about it.
She says she still has hope she'll get home, but it'll take time and money. She says her kids and her anger keep her going. For the world, Kaomi Getz, Seoul.
President-elect Donald Trump hasn't said much about what he plans to do about America's opioid epidemic, except for saying that building a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border would stop drug smugglers. The two issues are related, the opioid epidemic here and heroin production in Mexico. Prescription opioid abuse is often linked to heroin use later. And right now, heroin production in Mexico is booming to supply the growing U.S. market. My BBC colleague Ian Pannell ventured deep into drug cartel territory in Mexico to investigate.
The Mexican cartels have essentially responded to the prescription pill epidemic by increasing supply. So we went to Sinaloa province. We went into the jungle with a man they call the cook. We watched him take the raw opium take it through this chemical process and essentially produce powdered opium, which would go for something in the range of around $50,000 per kilogram on the streets of New York. But back there in Sinaloa, it's probably worth about $2,000. They were saying that they can't keep up with the amount of demand they're getting at the moment. We spoke to a smuggler in Juarez who was sending men, women, and children across the border with drugs hidden on their bodies, sometimes inside their bodies. And again, he says, partly because of the economic situation, that the people he sends across are willing to do anything for the money and the chance, obviously, of a better life.
Yes. So how much heroin is actually produced in Mexico for the U.S. market?
I couldn't tell you exactly what the total is, and I'm not so sure that anyone could give you an accurate figure other than to say that we know the number of seizures have gone up exponentially, and we know that consumption and death and addiction in the United States has gone up exponentially. I mean, for the cartels, this is a simple economic decision. If you are a farmer, and we spoke to farmers, they're making a choice. So some of the farmers, they used to grow marijuana. And of course, partly because of decriminalization or legalization in some U.S. states, there has been that market has just gone for them. The active compound inside marijuana is significantly stronger in the weed that is grown in the United States as opposed to in Mexico. So many consumers in the U.S. just don't want Mexican weed anymore. And so people are looking for an alternative in Mexico. Now, one farmer almost quaintly said he's no longer growing the green flower. He's now growing the red flower because there's more money in it. When he says the red flower, he means the poppy.
So President-elect Trump has promised to build the wall between the U.S. and Mexico and to deport illegal immigrants, especially those involved in criminal activities. How was his presidency, his candidacy anyway, seen by the smugglers and heroin producers you met?
As far as they're concerned, they've had the weight of the U.S. federal government law enforcement agencies against them for a very long time. You know, you've had the DEA and you've had the FBI and others waging a war on drugs for 45 years. I mean, having a president-elect who said that he's going to do something different, well, I don't think they're too bothered by that. I mean, they'll wait and see what happens. I've yet to see a government successfully put in place laws that effectively stop the flow of a drug trade that produces such great profits. I mean, I reported from Colombia last year, you know, and this is a country that's had an active drug war for a very long time, a war on drugs. Mm. And yet it's, you know, Colombia is once again the leading producer of cocaine, despite all the aerial eradication, despite going after the cartels. We've all been watching the show on Netflix about Pablo Escobar. I mean, all of that happened, all that death happened, all that heroin, all that cocaine was seized, all those people were killed, and yet it's still producing almost as much cocaine as ever. So, you know, those wars can go on and those battles are fought, but I've yet to meet anyone who thought that the war on drugs, which is 45 years old this year, wasn't anything like a success.
My BBC colleague Ian Pannell, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. It seems like a lifetime ago when we last spoke with Daily Show host Trevor Noah, but actually it was just last Wednesday. We had been speaking about the election and Trump's victory. Today we have the second half of my conversation with Noah about his struggles with identity growing up biracial in South Africa.
One thing you learn very quickly as a biracial person is that one half is just completely ignored. You will never, you know, experience any of its privileges or just advantages.
Noah has a new memoir out. He talks about the complexities of growing up in apartheid-era South Africa with a black mother and a white father. And in the book he writes, racism exists and you have to pick a side. You can say that you don't pick sides, but eventually life will force you to pick a side. I asked Trevor Noah what he meant by that.
When I say choose, it doesn't mean be in opposition to. I understand how quickly these conversations can devolve into something that seems like a battle cry, but it's not that. It's just you do have to choose. I mean, as much as we are humans, a lot of women in this election, you had to go, no, I'm a woman, and this is what I'm choosing, and this is the side that I'm coming down on. And life forces you to make those decisions. So in the face of misogyny or in the face of racism, you are reminded of the side that you are on, whether you choose it willingly or not.
You found, though, as a kid in South Africa that black families often kind of afforded you certain privileges, right?
Yeah.
But that was because I lived in a country where the government had made this the law. You know, according to the law, I was a person who was superior to half of my family because they were black and I was half white. So I grew up in a world where, according to the law, I was in a different position. And there were some people in my family and some people in my community who treated me accordingly. Now, luckily, I was a child. And so in my mind, I just assumed they were treating me like that because I was like a really cute kid. You know, as a kid, you don't ever think to yourself that anything positive you're experiencing is because of a political bias that's been put in place. You just see it as you being a child having a good time. And apartheid ended by the time I was a functioning human being. So I'm really lucky in that those ideas were never set into stone in my mind. I never got to experience them fully.
That identity struggle pretty much starts for you on day one, hence the title of your book, Born a Crime. Describe the scene in the delivery room when you were born. And I know this is not from memory. Can't be. Who told you the story?
Yeah,
your mother, I guess.
It's a really fun story. My mom tells the story of how in the delivery room, you know, I came out and the doctors cleaned me up. And then there was just an awkward pause where all of these doctors are standing around. And there is this black woman, and she has just given birth to a child that does not look black at all. And everyone's looking around basically for the culprit in the room, you know, just that awkward, awkward moment where everyone realizes what has happened because this was illegal in the country. You know, they called it a crime of miscegenation at the time. Anyone who was engaging in interracial relations. And so my mom says they just looked around very awkwardly and then handed me over to the nurse and then just had to play it off like nothing happened. And then later when questioned, my mom said, oh, no, his father is from Swaziland, which is a different country, and people in that country are light-skinned, and that's why he looks like that. Don't worry, he'll get darker over time, you know. But, you know, it's a wild story you have to tell, but it's a wild state that we were living in the time.
So we'll get to your father in a second, but your mother at the time worried that you might be taken away by the South African government. What would have happened to you?
Well, I think my gran worried more than my mom. My mom was always someone who didn't allow herself to be consumed by worry, but my gran was always worried that I would be taken away. You know, I could be taken away to an orphanage. If I was ever found to exist by the police, they would have had, you know, every right to take me away and send me off to an orphanage to be given away to a family who looked like me or at least shared some of my features so that I would not be diluting or polluting any of the blood, you know, in my community. And because that would just break down the laws of apartheid.
So your father, who was not in the delivery room, you describe him as very Swiss, particular, precise. He opened one of the first integrated restaurants in Johannesburg. In those years, apartheid years, you could only be with him indoors, right?
Yeah.
Explain that.
Being with my father in public was pretty much exposing the crime that you have committed as a family.
Mm.
You know, that's the equivalent of doing a line of coke on the sidewalk. You have to conceal your crime because that is exactly what it is. So my father and my mother knew that being seen with me was something that could lead the police to suspect. And then, you know, the next step would be to imprison my mom and then find my dad and take me away. So I only existed with him in closed spaces. You know, sometimes if we were out in public, I wouldn't walk with him.
Yeah, there's that just heartbreaking scene in a park where he's kind of walking ahead of you and you try and catch up with him. And he runs away from you. It's just...
Yeah, well, you see, it's heartbreaking in hindsight. I mean, at the time, I was just a kid running with my dad. You know, I was running and my dad was running and my mom was chasing me. And I thought, what a wonderful family I have. We're all running together. Now, they were running because of a very different reason, but I was having a fantastic life and I choose to keep it as that in my memory.
So you lost touch with your father for many years, and when you found him with the help of the Swiss embassy, you discovered that he'd been following your career. He had a scrapbook of your comedy appearances. What was that day like for you?
I can't lie. That was a surreal and beautiful moment for me. You know, as people, we can try to deny it, but being chosen is probably one of the most wonderful feelings you can experience as a human being. I think a lot of the time that's all we're doing. Going through our lives, we are trying to be chosen. We try to be chosen in a relationship. We try to be chosen in a job, try to be chosen in a community. And that being chosen gives you a sense of belonging. It makes you feel like you belong, and it makes you feel like you matter. And that's where parents play a big role, because when we are chosen by our parents, that becomes the foundation of how we see ourselves in the world. So for me, I always knew I was chosen by my mom. I knew my dad loved me, but because I'd lost contact with him for so long, for various reasons, I didn't exactly know, you know, if he still chose me. And then to get to a point where you meet a man after 10 years and you realize that not only was he still, you know, seeing himself as my father, but more importantly, was following everything I did in my life. That's a wonderful feeling, you know, a feeling that I think and I wish everyone would have, and that is to know that you mean something to someone who is, in essence, one half of what you are.
Trevor Noah is host of The Daily Show and author of the just released Born a Crime, Stories from a South African Childhood. Really great to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your time.
And that is our show today. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.